irony is we now have got a leader who doesn't sort of buy into that whole, you know, there's a certain responsibility of the largest country not to extract the last ounce of negotiation, with a guy who believes that we should, but at a time when, frankly, our negotiating leverage is less, and indeed, in some areas, significantly less.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest this week is friend of the show, Adam Schwarz. He's founder and CEO of Asia Group Advisors and one of the most astute Asia observers in the business. I wanted to ask him what he's thinking about Asia trade since the election of Trump and the changing role of the U.S. globally. China most often takes center stage, but I wanted a broader perspective. What does Trump mean for the rest of the Asia region, and how do other countries these days see and react to U.S. policies emanating from Washington? At the end of the day, what are the implications of China waxing and U.S. waning?
Why don't maybe we will kick off sort of looking at kind of economics and trade. I mean, that's one that's probably gotten the most commentary, and it's probably the one that Southeast Asia is the one most focused on. They have been both, and now I'm talking about they, sort of the leading Southeast Asian countries, have been among the biggest beneficiaries from, and therefore not so surprisingly, among the biggest supporters of a multilateral trading system. Mm-hmm. It's given them access to other markets for their goods and services, and it is, when I say it, I mean that multilateral trading system has been a very concrete, significant contributor for each of their journeys from poverty or less well-developed to more well-developed countries. So any threat or challenge to that world, most especially, of course, by the country that has, at least since World War II, been the leader and the loudest and strongest proponent of a multilateral trading regime, has sent shockwaves through the region.
So widespread disappointment with Trump's withdrawal from TPP.
Widespread disappointment. I think that was the original seismic shockwave. I think that a lot of South, you know, I'm often sort of surprised when friends in Washington tell me, well, you know, Southeast Asians shouldn't be so surprised by this. We've been saying, you know, Trump was saying this on the campaign trail. And actually, I think it's the opposite. I think, you know, basically many Americans and many friends of Southeast Asians will what they were saying is, listen, ignore everything you hear on the campaign trail because American presidents, you know, drop all that stuff on Inauguration Day and they do something else. So, you know, imagine the surprise of Southeast Asians, and I'm using that kind of, you know, somewhat simplistically, that on the very first day in office, President Trump withdraws the U.S. from the TPP, which is something that had really held the prospect of fundamentally changing the trade regime and the way trade was indeed defined in the Asia-Pacific region. And again, on top of that, it was essentially a U.S., although it wasn't a U.S. idea originally, but it was a U.S. creation by the time it had gotten to the final stage.
So before we go into the implications for Southeast Asia, let's talk about the economics of multilateral versus bilateral. How would you argue that you know, between the two, is there a definitive difference, or is one significantly beneficial over the other in your eyes?
Listen, I think that's a great question, because I think oftentimes the answer to that question gets blurred between economic theory and politics. In other words, what is economically brings the highest benefit versus what's politically possible to deliver. And I think it's useful, I mean, at the end of the day, they come together, but I think it's useful to at least bear in mind that those are two separate questions. And on the theory point of view, the larger the landscape, the larger the geography over which you apply a multilateral trade agreement or an economic integration agreement, the bigger the benefit. That's just economics.
Go ahead. So definitively, theoretically, global trade agreements are best for all economies.
Correct, because, well, they deliver the most aggregate economic benefit, okay, because the larger your production area, the lower your unit cost, the more you have. I mean, it just, without getting into the weeds of it, that's why we started out with, you know, trying to have global trade deals, whether it was a Doha round, WTO, GATT before that. Now, then you bring politics into play.
Yeah, so we've experimented with it, but now it appears that not everybody is a fan.
Not everybody's a fan. Not everybody wants to agree to essentially, you know, what you have to agree to accede to these global trading agreements.
Trade-offs.
And again, I mean, global trading agreements are evolving and progressing like everything else. So they go from tariffs and goods, and then they expand to services and, you know, other arenas of economic production. You know, you start getting into non-tariff barriers, and some countries that want, you know, were okay with how global trade agreements were defined in the beginning weren't so crazy about them as they became, you know, they cut a little closer to the bone. So global trading agreements, you know, tended to kind of lose countries as they progressed. And so what was the response to that was to go essentially to regional agreements, sub-global arrangements, whether that was the EU or NAFTA or Mercosur in South Asia, or, you know, in Southeast Asia, the ASEAN Economic Community, TPP is a version of that.
In order to bring these closer to home, get down perhaps to the more unique qualities of these sub-regional economies.
Yeah, or you'd get down to essentially a coalition of the willing. You know, you'd get countries that were kind of like each other, or they were neighbors, or they're more familiar with each other, or maybe they were at similar levels of economic development. There was some reason why they would be prepared to join a regional trade agreement, but they were not prepared to join a global one.
But now it feels like we're even retracting further into a period of now bilateral is better.
Right. Certainly the Trump view and at least some of his economic advisors is that bilateral is better, because their view is that their predecessors have done a lousy job of negotiating from America's perspective, or for America's benefit, these either global or regional trade agreements. And therefore, for America, bilateral is best. You know, my own personal view is that that's fundamentally misguided, and you know, America and many, many segments of American, you know, farmers, workers, consumers are going to be the losers from that. Both because, going back to our economic theory, you know, you're whether it's core, you know, agreement with Korea, or, you know, Trump says he wants to have a bilateral with the Japanese or the Malaysians, you know, or the Philippines, you know, to talk about Southeast Asia. But, you know, again, those aren't going to give you anywhere near the same bang for the buck that a regional, much less a global agreement, will give you at the economic theory level.
So sticking to the theory, if we in fact are in a period of retraction from global agreements, regional agreements, to bilateral agreements, a slide, if you will, shouldn't we see then a responsive decrease or decline in economic output, performance, and higher unemployment?
Short answer, yes.
But we don't.
Not yet, because we haven't done any bilateral agreements, and we haven't.
Well, there are bilateral agreements. Well, just those post Trump.
Well, those are predating Trump. You have the Korean bilateral agreement. I mean, some people call NAFTA, you know, kind of a pair of bilateral agreements. Right. You know, the U.S. Canada,
U.S. and Mexico, Canada. So
trilateral. We'll call that. So those predated Trump. He's now, of course, as you know, trying to renegotiate those into ways that they will better benefit the United States. And there seems to be some progress, but it's slow and gradual. But going back to the sort of the slide from regional to bilateral, I think there's more to be said on that, which is that it's not just a matter of that brings along with it a decline or an erosion of economic benefit that can be obtained by it. But I think it's also misleading when it's presented as a choice. What do I mean by that? I mean, you know, when you lay it out, all right, as the Trump administration does, we're going to do bilateral instead of multilateral. Well, you know, it's sort of the implication of that is that there is such a thing that the Trump administration could do. In other words, it could replace TPP, which had 12 members, now it has 11 members, with a set of bilateral agreements. Well, my view is that's just nonsensical. That was never going to happen.
Well, it's not going to happen, right? Because everybody's got their own view on that, and that's just going to be a lot of heavy lifting.
Exactly. And for a variety of reasons. I mean, one, you look at from what is the American administration able to do? The USTR, the United States Trade Representative, which is the U.S. government agency that negotiates trade agreements, is a tiny organization. I mean, it's dozens of people. The capacity of that agency to negotiate trade agreements is, you know, maybe one at a time, maybe two at a time. That's it.
Yeah.
And they're going to be fully occupied with the NAFTA and the CORIS renegotiation. So now when we say that, so that thesis is there's not going to be any detriment to the United States going from, let's say, because we're talking about Asia, from the TPP to bilateral, it's nonsense because we're not going to have any bilateral agreements to replace them. Even if we did, we have loss, we have diminishment in economic benefit. But the reality is, we're not going to have that anyway.
I'm Steve Stein, and my guest is Adam Schwarz, founder and CEO of Asia Group Advisors. We're talking about the ways in which the landing of Trump and Trumpian economics are reverberating in Southeast Asia. So here's the rub. If economic theory, and for that matter, economists, are telling us that multilateral trade agreements are the way to go, the way, if you will, to get more bang for the buck, then why is Trump so insistent on pursuing bilateral agreements? In a word, politics. By politicizing trade, Trump gives license to his declaration of America First. Bilateral, so he believes, makes America sound stronger, back in control. In practice, however, not only is it not easy, it's not even sensible. It's a move that threatens to push Asia closer to China and further away from the U.S. I asked Schwarz what he made of that strange dissonance.
I think he's arguing that the U.S. is the largest economy, you know, is a large economy, and it therefore has negotiating leverage that historically American leaders haven't fully utilized, because historically the United States has taken the view that the gains from big multilateral agreements need to be shared, and a kind of the hegemon, if you will, if the big country tries to extract the best possible deal, either no one or at least fewer countries are going to willing to join the club, to come to the party. And therefore, we haven't extracted the last ounce of negotiating leverage. Trump has a different view.
It's like time stopped in post-World War II, you know, when we did have the hegemony, and we are able to perhaps, you know, throw our weight behind these decisions. Time's moved on. Things have moved on. We don't have the same leverage. Isn't it true?
Well, that is true. So the kind of the irony is we now have got a leader who doesn't sort of buy into that whole, you know, there's a certain responsibility of the largest country not to extract the last ounce of negotiation, with a guy who believes that we should, but at a time when, frankly, our negotiating leverage is less, and indeed, in some areas, significantly less. And that's when, and so getting us back to your earlier question about Southeast Asia, this is the moment that we have. They're looking at this, all right, so the historical leader of globalization, multilateral trading arrangements, is all of a sudden, and, you know, kind of a flip of a switch, changed its mind and is completely, you know, coming out with a different narrative about trade. But at the very same time, we've got China, which is a very important economy to all of the Southeast Asian economies as an importer of goods, whether historically been raw materials, China would process them and export them. But, you know, China does increasingly import a lot of intermediate and finished goods from Southeast Asia as well. So, and, you know, people in Beijing obviously aren't asleep at the switch. They're looking at what's going on in Washington, and they're seeing this is a historical opportunity to make gains in Southeast Asia and sort of, in a sense, displace the U.S.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. Isn't there just an opportunity to trade out the U.S. for China now that it's a rising power, number two global economy, you know, a major manufacturer, you know, and also in demand of a lot of the natural products and commodities that Southeast Asia has to offer?
Well, listen, I think Beijing certainly looks at it that way, and we kind of like it to. I mean, we shouldn't forget that the Southeast Asian countries and Southeast Asia as a region also have a voice in this discussion. And, you know, from Southeast Asia's point of view, historically, they have defined themselves almost, you know, at a very core level as a hedge. You know, they want to balance great powers, and now it makes them very, nervous because if one power is arbitrarily taking it, is essentially abdicating the field of play, well, it's much harder to hedge that sort of situation.
So most of the Southeast Asian countries were able to play politics, play China off the U.S. from an economic trade perspective, and now you're saying that opportunity is less than what it was before.
It is less than what it was. And listen, I think we have to be careful. I mean, G2G relations is not the whole story. You know, there are markets, there are businesses, you know, commerce goes on. But when it comes to how governments look at the world and politics and trade-offs and, you know, how do we, you know, not become vulnerable or, you know, return to being vassal states from thousands of years ago or tributary states to China, you know, now you start hearing people in Southeast Asia start worrying about that. It's not something we've heard that we haven't heard that concern aired in a long time.
Well, considering the economic makeup of the U.S. versus China, can we look at some of the Southeast Asian nations to determine which have the most to gain and which have the most to lose based on this new reality?
Listen, I think it's not so much looking at it country by country. I mean, maybe you could do that a little bit. I think it's a little bit more by sector, you know, and function. As you know, the Trump administration's focus, somewhat oddly as well, has really been around goods, and it kind of, you know, ignored the service. To a certain extent, ignored the service economy.
Almost entirely.
Yeah, which, you know, again, it's just one of the many, many mysteries of Trumpian economic policy. So, you know, I think for companies that are selling a higher proportion of goods, whether it's kind of via China or directly, are a little bit more nervous. You know, those that are...
So this would be alternative manufacturing bases, Malaysia, Thailand to some degree with their auto sector, as opposed to the more commodity-based markets, agriculture-based markets like the Philippines or Indonesia.
Correct. I'd probably put Philippines a little bit in the middle there, but yeah, that's I think that's about right. You know, and then you've got the concern that, you know, what's going to happen to U.S. companies that are already invested in our countries? Is the Trump administration going to put so much pressure on them to repatriate profits, raise the pain level because of moving jobs, the claim of moving jobs overseas, that these companies are going to put on hold investment decisions, they're going to reduce investments, or they might pull out altogether.
As if it weren't difficult enough, you know, with different regulatory systems, currency fluctuations, trade barriers, there are all kinds of issues across Southeast Asia. Every market has its own set of conditions and challenges. It seems almost at odds with what we'd want to be doing as a country, the U.S. as a country, in terms of expanding trade, expanding commerce into these markets. Now incentives are being created to make it more difficult.
Yeah. Listen, I think if you look at trade and globalization and the expansion of, you know, trade regions as a inherently good thing, albeit with some flaws, but on balance a net positive thing, then, you know, virtually everything, you know, Trump is doing is a negative. Now, if you don't take that worldview, if you sort of believe that kind of we should focus more on leverage and mercantilism, and the big countries should demand a better deal by dint of the fact that they are bigger countries, and that we can have kind of a peaceful, you know, happily trading with each other world. If you take that approach, then okay, then you know they don't feel like you're losing anything because they believe that the world we're in historically has been not as good a deal for America that you could otherwise take.
Yeah,
but so I mean it does very much start with your own starting point,
your perception
of the world. Well, you know what you think leads to more growth on balance, what you think leads to more equitable growth and development on balance. I personally believe that, as I said earlier, that trade and globalization and expanding trade and investment and the stuff that comes with it is on balance a better option.
U.S. politics are deeply influenced by corporate interests, and there are many multinational U.S. corporate interests in Southeast Asia. What, if anything, can they or should they be doing to try to influence the Trump administration to defending and protecting the ability to trade or to develop multilateral or free trade agreements in Southeast Asia?
Well, listen, it's a great question. I'm not sure whether the horse has left the barn already on that one. I think, much like we were talking earlier about Southeast Asia governments and, not really taking campaign rhetoric seriously, I think, to a certain extent, you could say the same thing about U.S. business. Whether it's the Chamber of Commerce or the National Association of Manufacturers or, many of the big, groups that represent U.S. business in America and in Washington, D.C. in particular, what Trump was saying was so anathema to how they look at the world that they just didn't believe it. They didn't think he would do it.
So everybody was caught flat-footed, basically.
Yeah. And they liked some of the other stuff he was saying about cutting taxes and deregulation. And so they said, well, we like the stuff that we like, and we don't believe that he's going to do the stuff that we don't like. And so we're just going to kind of largely keep quiet. Now, of course, the error of that approach is coming home to roost.
Adam, are there other Southeast Asia countries that Trump has a gripe with, not dissimilar from China, or are both of them relatively compliant in at least from his worldview?
No, in the beginning, if you remember, just a couple of months in office, he instructed the U.S. Commerce Department to do a study of all the countries in the world that had a trade deficit in goods with the U.S. greater than $10 billion. And turns out there's 14 of those countries, and four of them are Southeast Asian countries. Mm-hmm. So there was Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, and Vietnam. So there was a lot of nervousness in those countries about, what was going to, and of course the study was, why do we have this deficit? Is it because we're not competitive or because there's investment barriers or trade barriers, et cetera? Answer, by the way, there's a lot of trade barriers. But the reality is, as we've all come to the view a year later, is that that was all kind of, just flack. The Commerce Department is really very much focused on China. Mm. And the rest of this is collateral damage if the Commerce Department does anything. And otherwise, it's just kind of noise.
Right. So, crystal ball, what's in store for Southeast Asian countries under this new trade regimen?
Well, listen, these countries are growing and, as I said earlier, commerce marches on, sometimes despite government's best efforts to slow it down. So as you've seen and you've talked about on your podcast before, the other 11 members of TPP, quite quickly, pulled their socks up and recovered. And now we have CPTPP, which is the 11 remaining members. And Japan, played a very important role in driving that forward, and that sends a very important signal. And those 11 members, in varying degrees of enthusiasm, would like to have the U.S. rejoin, but no one thinks that's likely to happen, at least in the near term. There is this RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is a separate trade deal. So, countries are moving. I mean, nobody in this part of the world is giving up on trade. I mean, there's no real equivalent in Asia to Donald Trump when it comes to this mercantilist, let's go back to the 1920s approach to trade.
Yet.
Yeah. I mean, we may get there. But even some of the leaders that are, who by the way do a lot of this stuff in practice, don't sort of brag about it. Mm. They're not out there talking about it. And they pay fealty to the benefits of the multilateral trade, arrangements and free trade, et cetera, including China. Now, it's hypocritical in a lot of ways. But there is something to be said to sort of keeping alive the notion that we believe in open markets and free trade. It's a very slippery slope we're on, because it's hard to know where it leads. And it can very easily, as we've seen historically in the past, lead to a set of tit-for-tat responses that then become very politicized and very hard to pull back from.
So the rules have been rewritten. The players are in place. People are anticipating additional engagement or additional tariffs or as you say, different stop gaps to it. But now we're going to see in probably the next 6 to 12 to 18 months what the real repercussions are.
That's right. I think that's a good way to put it. I think we are. We'll get to the midterm elections in the U.S. That'll be the 2-year mark, and we'll see whether there's a recalculation of how Washington views trade policy and how decisions that were made in the first 2 years are affecting different constituencies in America, including, many of the constituencies that voted strongly for Trump in 2016, like the agriculture sector, for example. And we'll see how Southeast Asian countries react to China's increasingly aggressive approaches through the Belt and Road Initiative, one-off infrastructure project funding, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, it's like water emptying an empty vessel at this point. How do you get in there? How do you give this money? And it's a very politicized process, and there, leaders in various Southeast Asian countries are benefiting from this funding, is oftentimes going through state banks. Crony businessmen close to, sitting political leaders are getting projects. It's not a clean sheet of paper. It's not very transparent. It's very political, and it's very deliberately political. But that doesn't mean it's not working.
Yeah. So this story is in its early stages. There's a lot more to come. A lot more drama.
Oh yeah, we're in the first act of this one. Yeah,
excellent, Adam. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
This is Inside Asia, and you've been listening to my interview with Adam Schwarz, founder and CEO of Asia Group Advisors. Thanks for listening. But before we go, let me offer up our Asia Insider Minute, a 60-second summary of our conversation capped with a few takeaways. Here it goes. First off, make no mistake, these are early days in the making of this trade melodrama. We're at the close of the first act, and the U.S. and China are playing leading roles. On the one side, you have an American president prepared to put into practice the policies born of campaign promises. Get tough on China. Save American jobs. It sounded good and probably helped him get elected. Unfortunately for Trump and for the country, it's bad economics and simply cuts against sound economic theory. On the other side, we have an emerging China, led by a preeminent leader, hell-bent and determined to exert more influence, not less, when it comes to global economic affairs. The supporting cast is comprised of Asia's other countries and respective leaders who may find themselves vassal states of a rising superpower if some semblance of reason isn't restored to U.S. trade policy. What would that look like? As my guest this episode, Adam Schwarz, points out, trade has empowered countries in the region once mired in colonial or economic underdog circumstances to move forward. To what degree will this burgeoning trade war subjugate broader Asia once again? Then there's the subplot and the question of how this plays out for Trump at home. If the rallying cry is America first at any cost, what happens when Americans are first to feel the economic pinch of a trade war gone wrong? As discussed with other guests in previous episodes, China trade retaliation will target the goods and services central to Trump's political base. Farm Belt and Rust Belt workers, beware. Like any dramatic production worth its mettle, this story will have its twists and turns. We're already seeing it. In early May, Trump made a move to ban sales of U.S. products to Chinese telecommunications company ZTE. A few days later, he reversed himself and said that an about-face was part of a wider move to ease the threat of $150 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese imports. Trump's reasoning, and I quote, "Too many Chinese jobs will be lost." What? Chinese jobs? Did we hear this right? It begs the question, has Trump suddenly grown empathetic to global repercussions of a trade war where any job lost anywhere is a bad thing? Or is he laying the groundwork to run for the Chinese presidency, figuring that if he unseats Xi Jinping, he can control the outcome and make every country great again? If the latter, maybe someone should let Trump know that China has given democracy a pass. Chinese don't vote, so Trump for president is unlikely, at least for now. So stay tuned. The plot thickens. Return to your seats. Act Two is about to begin. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein saying come in from the outside on Inside Asia.